All right, welcome on into the Internalist Show. I believe this is episode 35. I think that's right. It is April 29th, 9:06 p.m., Monday night. Got the Twins on the TV, currently watching them play the Chicago White Sox. Top six tie ball game. Eddie Julian is at the plate. Big week for the Twins. That'll be part of what we talk about today, but obviously a lot going on elsewhere as well. The Wolves clinched their first round playoff matchup last night, swept the Suns four games 0-4. See ya. What do you say? 0-2 barbecue, 0-4 barbecue, 0-4 something that rhymes with four. They'll be in Cancun, probably right now, honestly. And then, obviously, the big draft for the Vikings. We previewed it a bunch. I have my thoughts, obviously. Probably not as I think I'm considerably more negative than the average Vikings fan is right now, but not as negative as you might think based on what I've been saying on this podcast for the past couple weeks. But we'll get to all of it. Let's also an interesting post game. I think I want to invent something that's this post game. Let's get started. We'll start with the Wolves because, you know, they're the Minnesota team playing playoff action right now. By the way, are the Wild in the playoffs? I feel like no, they were really shitty last time I checked, right? I meant to check in on the Wild like a week or two ago, and I just never remembered to do that. Oh, wait. I'm confused. How do you make the playoffs in the Wild? In the Wild card. So we were like 11 points off of the wild card. Tough. All right, well, we didn't make the playoffs. I should absolutely not be using the word we when I refer to the Wild, but I just kind of use it with everything. Anyway, like I said, the Wolves are the only Minnesota team actually in playoff action right now, as exciting as stuff is for the Vikings and Twins right now. But like I said, we swept the Suns 4-0. The only game that was really close, that was really in doubt, was the clinching game, game four. Because we came out kind of missing everything, shot really badly in the first half. Ant was kind of off his game, wasn't making his shots, had only 9 points at the half. Then he just completely detonated for 31 in the second half. Ended up winning the game, I wouldn't say comfortably, but it was, you know, every minute mattered, but it wasn't like there was any last second shot. There was no like ref call that went either way that could have swung the game or whatever. It was ended up being a, I guess comfortable is the word. Eventually at the very end, it was, you know, pretty clear who was going to win that game. But yeah, all series, it just seemed like, I think, well, we'll go about this two different ways. We'll start with how kind of badly the Suns looked for most of the series. Kevin Durant is a very, very good basketball player. He's even a great basketball player even at this stage of his career. He was honestly consistently pretty darn good. Game two, he wasn't that great numbers-wise. Game two was, they kind of laid a stinker in general. And Jaden McDaniels pieced them up. But outside of Kevin Durant, who was like pretty good to almost great pretty much every single game, the other two of this big three, one of them was good some of the games, and then the other one was good some of the games, but like at least three or four of these games, one of them stunk. And this, you know, closeout game, Brad Beal stunk, shot a very low percentage and scored only 9 points. If he has even an okay game, they probably win that game and the series is extended. They gave us Scott Foster for game four, known as the extender. They bring him in to extend series that are going to be sweeps. We defeated Scott Foster. Also, I think we've had a couple run-ins with Scott Foster this year. The Timberwolves as a team have. But anyway, I have some notes. I mean, obviously, it's all in the series and stuff like that. But, Phoenix, they just... Two out of their big three played okay each game, and one of them mostly stunk each game. They were just really soft. I think they're the softest, laziest, like, can't handle adversity team with a lot of talent in the entire NBA. I think you have two glorified catch and shoot guys that have tried to add something to their game, but aren't really creators themselves. Honestly, this is the most disrespectful anybody's ever been to Kevin Durant before, but, like, Kevin Durant's best skill is shooting the basketball. Catch and shoot. Nobody can block the shot. He can get a shot up over anybody. He's one of the best offensive players of, you know, my lifetime. But his best skill is shooting the basketball. And the other two's best skill, Devin Booker's best skill, is shooting the basketball. Brad Beal's best skill, kind of by far, is shooting the basketball. And there was nobody to create space. There was nobody to find assists. There was nobody to, like, sort of get in the middle of the defense, pull people to them to get some of these shots open. Like, people have been talking online a lot about how Phoenix doesn't have a point guard, and they just don't. And it was pretty clear in this series that a point guard is exactly what they needed. This is not a criticism of Kevin Durant, because I think, like, what he did is kind of exactly what he's always done, and he's the guy that the offense runs around. But if your two secondary stars kind of do the exact same thing to varying degrees of success, then, like, you don't really have two stars, because they're just going to fill the same role. Like, imagine if you replace Brad Beal with, like, a Kyrie. And maybe that's not fair, because Kyrie's better than Brad Beal, but, like, that would be such a more difficult series for the Timberwolves, because of what Kyrie brings to the table. And you still have the catch-and-shoot superstar that can make every shot, but also get his own. Like, that's the sort of, like, like, model or, like, mold of star that Devin Booker and Brad Beal, they're both catch-and-shoot guys sort of at their core, but that can do other stuff and can carry more of a load. The other thing is, Bradley Beal has not played a lot of playoff basketball. Not since John Wall was around in Washington, and they maybe, like, won one series and then were out most of those years. And Devin Booker is very, very soft. Like, one of the softest excuses for a star that we have in the NBA. He is, like, I don't know. I've always hated Devin Booker. I don't understand where people, like, come up with the fact that he's, like, this superstar, or, like, comparing to Kobe just because he wears Kobe's shoes. Like, it's one of the stupidest things that we do, or that, like, people who talk about the NBA do, is to try to pretend that Devin Booker is some kind of superstar or some kind of, like, killer. Like, he's not. He's never has been. Like, that sort of idea of who he is came from, like, four games in the bubble when they didn't even make the playoffs. And then since then, like, what has the Suns team ever done? They've had a ton of talent and never done anything with it. Like, he's been given everything he could ask for, and he got swept by a star that's way younger than him, a guy that was on the same Kentucky team as him that people have been criticizing and saying he was worse in Cat. I'm the king of choking and coughing my lungs out on podcasts. and then Rudy, who, you know, is Rudy. But, I don't know. that's the Suns side of things. On the Wolves side, I think this team, as corny as it sounds and maybe cliche or whatever, benefited so much from Cat being out for a month or however long it was. The way that that team sort of stepped up when he was gone, and the way that Ant sort of, he was always kind of like this. He was always capable of taking over a game and being completely dominant when he kind of wanted to be or when he was on. But the way that he just sort of allowed himself to do that more and more often when Cat was out, and he can kind of just tap into that same sort of thing now. Like, watching the second half of the game last night, it was, you know, I mean, first of all, at half, we're down 6 points or whatever it is, and hadn't shot well, hadn't played well at all. And within 5 minutes of the third half, or third quarter starting, you could tell that Anthony Edwards was just on that sort of a different level than he was on the first half. And you're like, okay, we're going to win this game. He's just going to find a way to make it happen. And that's an incredible feeling to have a superstar like that, where when he's on, he can just kind of make the game go the way he needs it to go. And I think a big difference from maybe even the beginning of the year a little bit, when we had dealing with some of those blown leads, is that right now, when Anthony Edwards isn't getting his own shot, when he's not the main guy offensively, or maybe he's missing shots that he usually makes, like when he's not quite on offense, he's still incredibly beneficial to have out there, just, you know, always making the right play, always making the defense work, and also good on defense. Because, I mean, that's what happened. Like, this Timberwolves team last year, or maybe the beginning of this year, even when we were really good record-wise the beginning of this year, the way that first half was happening for us, it would have been a bit of a wider margin in the past than it is now. And that's a testament to Ant. It's a testament to all the sort of other role players that found a bigger role. Nikhil Alexander-Walker was great. Defensively, Rudy was outstanding. I don't look at the numbers yet, but the other three games of the series were relatively easy, to be honest. But this last game showed a lot about sort of where this team is now. Let me just go through any more notes I had. I really wanted to real quick talk about it was like 113 to 111 last night. Game very much in the balance at this point. The Suns run like a mini run. They'd maybe scored 4 points in a row, something like that. Got in a bucket, got in a stop, got in a bucket, got in a stop. And then they were on offense. And they had a really, really good possession in which they were passing the ball all around the perimeter. Just really moving the ball well. Really connected offensively for, you know, a somewhat rare occurrence for them, to be honest. And just every single closeout was right where it needed to be from the Minnesota defense, just sprinting to get a hand up. Never really got any shot off. Eventually, they ran out of room to swing the ball around the three-point line, attempted a bounce pass across the baseline, intercepted. I believe it was McDaniels. Might have been Alexander Walker that intercepted it. Get it out to Ant in the semi-transition, gets around his guy, and then that is when he just completely baptized Kevin Durant on the dunk. And that's the type of thing that, like, I mean, first of all, when that play happened, I was like, yeah, we're winning this game. Like, they just went on a little run, but they're winning this game. Also, that's the type of thing where I know that Ant tries that thing every time. He does kind of the same dunk over and over again. He just gets way up and then just sees what happens. He has never shied away from trying to poster somebody. Almost immediately when he sort of got around the shoulder of this guy, I knew that the posterization was coming, or at least it was going to be attempted. and it's almost like he's either going to, like, miss the dunk or he's going to make it. And the question is never is he not going to go for it. But it's still incredibly exciting when it comes off, obviously. But yeah, obviously a huge moment in that game, just sort of indicative of how the series went in general. though Anthony Edwards being better than Kevin Durant in this series was a big storyline nationally. A lot of talk between them two, a lot of trash talking, which is great. I love to see it. And KD loves to see it too, you know. Credit to him, he was very respectful, maybe isn't the word, but was very like accepting of the trash talk. He's like, yeah, if you win, then you get to talk shit. So that was cool to see as well. Anyway, let me go through some notes. Obviously, the sweep wailed. This is a note I have. Devin Booker is a bitch and always has always been a bitch. All right, good. Yeah, and just a note about Booker. Booker was really good, credit to him, in the last game. Beal was horrible. So, you know, Booker was good. Chris Finch. The note says Chris Finch ACL with like 7 question marks because we didn't know what it was at the time. It ended up being a torn patellar tendon, which obviously sucks. Kind of crazy to feel like coach injuries don't happen that often. The main one I remember is like the Georgia State coach in like the Sweet 16 in like crutches on March Madness. I don't know. 5-7 years ago, it was RJ Hunter's dad, whatever his name is. It was a father-son coach situation. that's the last coaching injury I can really remember, but yeah, I have a note. Shout out McDaniels for game 2. I mean, he went off. We mentioned that a little bit. We won the rebounding battle almost like in dominating fashion every single game this series. You know, that's going to happen when we play 2 7-footers in the starting lineup. I think, speaking of, like, little bitch soft players, like, I think Yusuf Nurkic probably gets that a little bit. I mean, it's just very clear when you have 2 7-footers that are very skilled, and, I, you know, people are going to roast Rudy for not being that skilled offensively, but as a defender, he is more skilled than anybody. He's literally the defender of the year. But watching a guy like Yusuf Nurkic reminds you that, oh, wait, 7-footers aren't always supposed to be doing the things that our 7-footers are doing, because that guy's kind of shitty at the sport of basketball. Anyway, I also have the Suns are the softest little bitches in the NBA. and then I have the words ethical basketball. Real quick, because I've already talked a bunch about this and kind of been yapping. That is kind of the point of a podcast, is to yap. But the Wolves do not play for fouls. They never have. We sort of get screwed by the refs often. Cat is bad at getting stupid fouls on defense. But Anthony Edwards' game has never been based on drawing fouls the way that James Harden game was based on drawing fouls, the way that at times KD's game has been based on that. Devin Booker's been a little bit of it too, to talk specifically about the Suns. But even like a guy like Shea, a guy like Joel, like these are guys that a lot of their offensive production comes from the foul line because it's a part of what they do. It's a part of their skill set is to get guys in the air and then get to the line. That has never been part of what Anthony Edwards does. He doesn't play that way. He wants to go over you, not get you up and then like run into you to get to the line. Like, and I'm just wondering, because these games went incredibly differently, especially on the offensive end for us, than, well, I guess offense and defensively, because we had one game where we got killed, than they did in the... By the way, Christian Vasquez just stole a base. What the hell am I looking at? These new bases have it as everybody's stealing. He might have been out. He led... What is he doing? He beat the ball by a mile, but then his front foot didn't actually touch the base. So, yeah, he's out. Anyway. So, you don't run with the backup catcher. What was I saying? Oh, the games in the regular season went completely differently than these playoff games went. And I wonder if that's just because
when the whistle tightens up a bit, it doesn't hurt us at all because we're already the best team in the league at defending without fouling. None of our offense is really based on drawing fouls. And so I wonder if that is something that's going to really, really help us in the playoffs. Maybe it is exactly what has already caused us to sweep the Suns so easily, and I wonder if that's just going to be a really big feather in our cap going forward. The other problem is, and this gets us into the next thing, is the Nuggets also don't play for fouls. Jokic is one of the cleanest, sort of most efficient players in the league without going to the foul line a bunch. And so, I don't know, the way that this series went, and I don't want to, like, get ahead of ourselves, because we do this as Minnesota fans. We won one series, and I would think we're fucking shit. I feel like the way that this upcoming series goes, assuming the Nuggets win, which as many games as the Lakers can win is great, but assuming the Nuggets win that series, I think we're both kind of okay beating the Thunder. I don't know. That's how I feel. I think at that point their youth is going to sort of cause a problem, and I guess we're young too, but I feel like we have a little bit of a Western Conference Finals in the Western Conference semifinals situation. But definitely don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Will we beat the Nuggets? I think I'm optimistic. I think we looked really good in this series, even though the Suns are probably a little bit fraudulent. I think the Nuggets are a really good team, but at no point throughout the year when we played them, and, you know, some people were down at certain times. Jamal Murray was out for a little bit. Banham was out for us. At no point of the year did I feel like, wow, this Nuggets team is, like, way better than us. Like, you'd get the Twins on the same field as the L.A. Dodgers, and you're like, wow, that team is way better than us. Like, I never felt that way. They might both be playoff teams by the end of this thing. I never felt that the Nuggets were significantly better than us. and it seems like they've been talked a lot as, like, clear in the sort of media in general as, like, clearly the best team in the West. And maybe clearly the best team in basketball. Maybe I'm blind because I'm biased or whatever, but I just don't see them as significantly better than us. We'll see how it works over 7 games, obviously. But excited for it. Jesus, I can't talk. I'm going to take a water break, and then we'll move on to the draft. For a guy that is like a week away from having, or like a week and a half away from having a master's degree and using the voice, you'd think I'd be able to talk a little bit better. Okay, we'll get to the draft. First thing I want to say is I don't think the Vikings made any bad picks. Obviously, I have my thoughts about J.J. McCarthy. I liked the trade up to get Dallas Turner. I liked it. I was a big fan of that. We're using a lot of draft capital this year, we're not going to have as much in the future. But even though we traded up to get him, he still fell and is one of the best defensive players in the draft. So love to see that. The corner we got in round whatever that was, three? Was it three or four? I think it was four. Yeah, Kyrie Jackson. I don't know anything about him. I know that this was a good cornerback draft, and I know that he thinks he's the best corner in the draft. So I like the fact that we got a corner, you know, and I was kind of slightly in favor of getting one pretty early, but just because of how sort of deficient that unit has been on the Vikings for the past few years. But we got one, and there's a lot of really, really good corners in the draft. I don't know. I didn't, like, obviously crunch the tape on any of them, but I just know there's a lot of really good ones. So glad we got him. Now, to the quarterback situation, right? Obviously, it's our first pick. It's the most important pick. It's the one that everybody's talking about. Based on the fact that Michael Penis went 8, which we'll get to the Michael Penis thing in a minute here, and the fact that Bo Nix went 12, I'm glad we took JJ at 10. Because if we would have waited till 23, which we had at one point, it's been traded like 4 times since then, but we had going into the night, we had 23. If we had waited till 23 and not actually gotten a quarterback, I think that would have been bad. And I may have mentioned Spencer Rattler's name at one point on this podcast. Realistically, I'm glad we didn't end up with Spencer Rattler as like our quarterback coming out of the draft. And so I think it was the correct pick to take J.J. McCarthy when we did. I am also very happy we didn't move up to 4 to do so. A lot of my criticism of J.J. McCarthy has been, over the past few weeks, like, was within the context of the idea that we'd have to move up to 4, and also with the assumption that a guy like Bo Nix or even Michael Penis will be available in the second round or late first. Like, if my dream scenario, right, for this draft was 2 defensive players in the first round, an edge and a corner, with our 2 picks that we had moving in, and then with our second round pick, which I don't know if we, which we ended up trading away, right? Obviously. Yeah. I would have loved for that to have been like a Bo Nix, you know? But because then I feel like that would have been a lot better value. That ended up not being a situation that was anywhere close to reality, so that I'm not like going to complain that we sort of went the way the draft board made us go, and we did what we had to do. Because we ended up not getting, like people are saying Michael Penis is bad value in 8, and obviously he is. And people are saying that for Bo Nix because they thought he was going to go much later. Nobody really thinks that J.J. McCarthy at 10 is bad value, and I think that's fair. So I'm glad we didn't overpay for him, I guess. So again, not criticizing the pick. That being said, I just don't think he's going to be that good. If you look at it, I was planning on doing this research before, and then I forgot. So apologize if this is a little bit like scattered here. If you go, like, so the primary attractions for like why a team would want to draft J.J. McCarthy are mostly that he's a winner, right? We've heard that 1,000 times over the past like 3 weeks. Is like he really knows how to win. And the next thing is that like he played in a pro style offense, and so he can easily understand pro concepts. He played under a former NFL head coach, blah 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 blah, and that's all fine and good. That being said, we're gonna go through the past, I don't know how many drafts, we're gonna see how long it takes, and we're gonna look at all the first round quarterbacks that are so-called winners and how they've done in the NFL. On the other side of the so-called winners and like the pro style guys that are like ready to go and whatever, all the intangibles guys, is the super raw talent guys. And some guys it's completely arm talent, some guys it's arm talent mixed with legs, but like maybe didn't play super high level college football, maybe didn't win that many games in college, maybe played in a way that was unfamiliar to the NFL at the time, but there was just too much talent to pass up some of these guys. These guys are usually people that went a little bit later than the pro-ready guys, and obviously it's the combination of guys who have super high-end talent and are pro ready and are winners. So those guys usually go number one, two, or three. Anyway, in 2023, Bryce Young was picked number one. His main characteristics was that he was a really good processor and that he won a lot of games. How has he been? Has he been good? No, he hasn't been. So that's one winner that hasn't won. Obviously, it's really early. CJ Stroud is what I would call a complete prospect. He had won a lot, had the high level upside, had the arm talent, had the prototypical size, all of it. He's obviously been great, but those were one and two picks. The fourth pick, Anthony Richardson, a guy that didn't win a lot in college, but the athletic upside and the arm upside was so incredible that he was too good to pass up. Not necessarily a winner, not necessarily pro ready, super raw, but was still already really good in Indy, even when he got hurt. And so those are the quarterbacks for this year, right? So that is one so-called winner that hasn't been good, one complete guy that has been great, and one raw guy that was really good. Next year, nobody got drafted. It was Kenny Pickett. He was kind of nothing. If there was anything about Kenny Pickett that people liked is that he was, like, gritty, but it was, like, there's really nothing there. It was a horrible quarterback here. All right, next year. Trevor Lawrence drafted number one. He's a complete prospect, and even then he's been a little bit disappointing. Zach Wilson, he's an elite-level talent guy. He's been disappointing. People drafted him for his upside. He hasn't been good. Trey Lance, people drafted him for his upside. He hasn't been good either. So I'm not saying that drafting people for their upside is any kind of slam dunk either. But then we get Justin Fields, drafted for his upside. I would argue that he's been actually pretty good. You get Mac Jones, drafted because he was a winner, drafted because he won multiple national championships at Alabama, through to a number of NFL-ready receivers in an NFL system, just kind of looked the part. He's been a complete dumpster fire in the NFL. Honestly, the way that we've been talking about J.J. McCarthy over the past month or two reminds me a lot of the way we talked about Mac Jones. You don't ever see the high-end upside on tape, but you just kind of assume that it's there because he won so many games. And if he turns anything close to Mac Jones, we're going to be severely disappointed. We can go back one more year. We have Joe Burrow. He's a complete prospect, showed the high-end upside in college, also won a ton of ball games. Tua Tagovailoa was drafted for his leadership skills, for his intangibles, for his processing skills. Everybody knew he didn't kind of have that high level arm talent, and he has been really, really mediocre in the NFL. Have they won a lot of games? Yes. Has it been because of the system? Yeah, probably. Has he often held them back in the playoffs and against really good teams in the regular season? Most definitely. Second of all, Justin Herbert won a lot less than Tua did in college, had a lot of worse mistakes, had a lot of bad interceptions in college. That team lost games that they should have won, and he has been incredible in the NFL. So, again, Tua was the winner. Justin Herbert was the high-level upside guy. Which of them has been better in the NFL? It's been Justin Herbert. Jordan Love drafted 26th. Out of Utah State, did not win a lot, but the arm talent was what was he was drafted for, and he has been pretty good in one season. We'll see. Let's just go one more year. This is probably getting annoying. I'm just trying to show that this, like, is kind of the way things are. Kyler Murray, kind of a complete prospect, won a lot in college. Also, people loved his high-level upside. Was a little bit of a different prospect because of how small he was. And he's been, like, pretty mediocre. Daniel Jones. As weird as it is to remember now, Daniel Jones was drafted this high because he was a pocket passer, processed well at Duke, could make all the throws look the part, blah, 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 blah. Did he win a lot of games? No, but the pro-style stuff was there. And he has been really not good in the National Football League. Dwayne Haskins is another quarterback in the first round. I'm not going to touch that. May he rest in peace. But hopefully the point has been made, kind of made at this point. People that we call winners and super ready for the NFL in college, like, almost all of them have failed. And so, like if you go back to Patrick Mahomes' draft, right? Like, like, Patrick Mahomes was completely unproven. Nobody had really ever heard of him. He had a losing season at Texas Tech. He was a losing quarterback. And now he's kind of already the second best quarterback of all time because the upside was there. Think about a guy drafted super hot because he won so much and because his attitude was so good. Baker Mayfield. Are we going to be happy with 4 years of Baker Mayfield moving forward? We just aren't. My biggest fear of J.J. McCarthy is not that he's going to be okay, not that the team is going to function, because it will. My biggest fear is that it's 4 years of kind of okay, and then we don't know what to do with the fifth-year option, and then we're just we kind of have to pay him because he's shown flashes, and then we're just kind of stuck in mediocrity forever. That's how I feel about him. Go to the Baker Mayfield draft. Josh Allen. Again, threw like less than 50% completion percentage in college. Did not win a lot of games. Looked like a mess, but he had a huge arm. Guess who's one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL now? The non-winner, non-efficient Josh Allen, just because he's more talented. Also in that draft, Josh Rosen was really, really good in college. Won a lot of games. Not in the league anymore. So I think the point is made. Being a winner at a college doesn't actually mean anything. It almost usually means that you don't have enough talent to be called anything else. That being said, this might be an all-time yapping edition of the podcast. That being said, I don't think we could have done anything else. So, whatever. Also, like, this is probably the last time I'm going to shit on J.J. McCarthy. Like, I want him to be good, obviously. Like, if he's very good and I'm super, super wrong about this, I'll be incredibly happy. So I'm not going to, like, cheer against him. I don't want that rumor to be out there. But just saying what I think. By the way, the Twins, we got to figure out how to hit again. I'm going to get there in this podcast. But Michael Penis was drafted number 8th. Now, listen. Talk about guys that I'm a fan of. Michael Penis. I was a huge fan of him after that one semifinal game. Sort of walked back my tone a little bit with the game, the championship game. If you think that the Falcons made a good decision by drafting Michael Penis, you do not know ball. There is no... Like, any argument that you make for me for it to be a good decision that they drafted Michael Penis with the 8th overall pick when they paid $100 million to Kirk Cousins, so in free agency, if you think in any way that that's a good idea, you do not know ball. And so I'm going to, like, if I had to make a ball-knowing test, it'd be like that. That would be the first question on the do you know ball test. And it's honestly a very easy question to get right. But there's people out there that are convincing. There's people out there with jobs on TV, and maybe they're told to have this horrible opinion because to make their TV show interesting. But there's people out there with the actual opinion that it's a good idea. And here's why it's not. If you pay a quarterback $100 million, you, like, by definition, are kind of going all in on your offense being really good. And it's hard to build a winning roster in the NFL, and tying up a lot of annual money in your quarterback is a good way to make sure that the other positions are very thin. We've seen a lot all over the NFL the past few years. When that happens, it's kind of a struggle. And so one really, really good way to fix that is by drafting really, really good position players with your high draft picks to just kind of slot either into the offense or to help out their defense. The one way you do not do that is waste your 8th overall pick and the rookie money that guy's going to get paid on a backup player. It's just stupid. Also, the guy that you just signed, like, you can make the whole like goodwill argument, like why would he be happy to have just not like, I'm excited, I signed a bunch of money with the Falcons, I'm excited to get to work. Okay, you just signed my you drafted my replacement literally a month after I signed with you. That's crazy. Obviously, the Falcons general manager, I watched the press conference, I already forgot his name, he's an idiot, came out and said, this is not a move for right now, Kirk is our quarterback, this is a move for the future. Okay, well, Kirk is on a four-year contract, getting paid $2,500, $2,500, Jesus, well, that's different, $25 million average annually, guaranteed, for 4 years. And so, if the plan is to wait for 4 years, then Michael Penis, first of all, will be 27 years old when that contract is up, or like 28, because I think he's going to be 24 by the time the NFL season starts. And he'll immediately be heading into his fifth-year option, having never played, so you don't know what to do with that at all. And if the plan is for Kirk to not play 4 years and for Michael Penis to come in a year or two, then why the hell did you sign Kirk to that money for that many years? It just makes no sense. I've heard the take that, okay, you really, really love Michael Penis. You don't think he's going to come around at a draft spot that you're going to have for the next 4 years. So, like, you get him now and you just kind of deal with whatever happens. Just, like, to make sure you have a succession plan in place, right? Last year, Michael Penis was nowhere on anybody's draft board. So if you're trying to predict 2-3 years down the line on who's going to be a really high draft pick, that guy, you don't even fucking know who he is yet. The year before Joe Burrow was picked number one, if he would have declared for that year's draft, he would go in the sixth round maybe at best. And then the next year he's the number one pick and now he's a superstar in the NFL. That stuff happens. So to be like, okay, in 2-3 years, we don't like how it looks, like we're going to draft our guy now and just stash him away for a while, it's just insane. It doesn't make any sense. There's no actual reasonable way to justify it. The other thing is everybody's pointing at the Green Bay situation, the way that Green Bay has handled it over the past, I mean, it's 20 years now. Now, has Green Bay done a really, really good job at getting quarterbacks to, like, succeed their really good quarterbacks? Right, they have. We'll start with Aaron Rodgers. If your, like, way of copying Green Bay is to say, okay, well, they did this with Aaron Rodgers, so we have to do that with Michael Penis, you are then equating Michael Penis with one of the top five quarterbacks in the history of football, as crazy as of a person as he is. That is the where he fits in this league's history. So you're like, okay, well, it worked with Aaron Rodgers. It's like being, okay, so like having your quarterback go out with an injury and a backup coming in is like what worked with Tom Brady. So like, let's do that. Like, it makes no fucking sense. But then you're like, okay, well, they did it with Jordan Love successfully, right? Blah, 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 blah. Is it successful? He's been good for 1 year. You know who was a Pro Bowl after their first year? Mac Jones. Where's he now? Like, is Jordan Love even that good? We don't even fucking know. Did he have a really good year? Sure he did. But, like, it was also 2 years of chaos with Aaron Rodgers where he could have used another fucking receiver that he trusted that you could have drafted in the first round, and that team may have won the Super Bowl. But instead they didn't because he was – couldn't throw to anybody other than Alan Lazard and Randall Cobb, who's 90 years old. And he also hated the front office, and they had a whole big fiasco every offseason, partially because of the Jordan Love pick. So has that even really worked? Like, is that what you want to point to and say, like, yeah, that's the model, like, we're going to do that? Like, is that – like, why are we so convinced that the Green Bay Packers did such a good job? Did they get really lucky with Aaron Rodgers? Absolutely. Is Jordan Love probably pretty good? Probably is. But, like, unless Jordan Love then goes and wins a couple Super Bowls, like, he kind of cost them potentially a chance for more with how sort of badly the Aaron Rodgers situation went down. So, like, the best case scenario that Atlanta's pointing to is a situation that arguably, And like, it probably is like, they, the Packers probably did the right thing, but it's not like for sure that they did the right thing. Also, Jordan Love was drafted in the back half of the first round as a very, very young and raw prospect with a quarterback that was, you know, perpetually signing 1-year deals and trying to get out of there. Michael Penix was drafted 8th overall. When you can get a top-end talent at the most important positions in football, we're still in the, like, top-end wide receivers, top-end edge rushers, top-end corner. Like, the top-end tackles were still there. The most important positions in football, other than quarterback, which you already have, you're able to build your team that way at that point. So they took the 8th pick to draft a 24-year-old with horrendous knees, who then isn't going to play for 4 years. It just, like, it's not the same situation. To say that it's the same strategy is insane. Also, has that strategy even worked for the people that, you know, were in a best-case scenario? I don't think it has. Anyway, that's my Michael Penix stuff. I think everybody listening to this probably agrees with me, but just had to get some of that off my chest. Jesus Christ. Looking at my notes, I said a mean thing about Brock Purdy and J.J. McCarthy, so I'm not going to say it out loud because I'm done being mean to him. I think in like a totally not like old man way, I think I don't like Caleb Williams. I know that like everybody that's like, oh, Caleb Williams paints his fingernails, he's Gen Z, I hate him. Like, it's kind of annoying, like it has nothing to do with the way he plays football. But I kind of see it. The way he took the stage, I was like, that guy would be annoying in high school. That guy would be annoying if I, like, knew him. If I were to, like, play on an intramural team with that guy in college, like, I would have not liked him. And so, you know, I don't know. He didn't pass that test for me. He's obviously going to be great. But I think I've yapped enough about the draft. The Twins, the Minnesota Twins. Minnie and Paul. I'm watching them right now. It's tied in the 8th. But whether or not this game is a dub or not, as of right now, we're on a 7-game winning streak. Talked last time about how the offense is worse in the league and all this other stuff, but how it should turn around soon. Well, guess what? It's turned around. Now, has it turned around because we played the White Sox and then the Angels and now we're back playing the White Sox? Absolutely, that's why it's turned around. But it's still good to see some good baseball being played. And this type of stuff is, like, simple as it sounds, like, will give a guy confidence to, you know, hit against shitty teams for a week and all of a sudden I'm hitting better. Okay, now I remember how this feels. Like, now I'm confident and go do it in other games. I haven't looked up the actual team stats and on where we rank now. Griffin Jack's Wales, let's go. Just struck out the guy to end the inning. But obviously it's much better because, like, I think there's 8 guys that have an OPS over 1,000 this past, like, in the last 7 days, which has been obviously these 7 wins. And for all, you know, obviously my audience knows ball incredibly, but for maybe they're like girlfriends in the car who don't know ball, OPS is on base plus slugging, and 1,000 is like incredibly good, like very, very good. Like 800 is good. So 1,000 is great. And the fact that 8 guys are OPSing over 1,000 for the past week is a incredibly significant difference to how it was going for the first month or so of the season at this point. I guess not a month, it would have been like 3 weeks of the season before this past week. So that's good. Obviously 7 wins is exactly what you want. Again, bad opponents, but it matters in the standings the exact same. And so now we're above 500 for the first time all year. Just kidding, we won the first 2 games of the season, but the first time since then, we're above 500. Still 4 games back, but, you know, obviously all standings don't really matter right now. It's just trying to get wins. Julianne is starting to hit better. He was batting below 200 coming into this week. Batted around 300 so far this week. Up to 7 pumps on the year. He's leading the team in pumps. Similarly, Carlos Santana, 3 pumps this past week. His average is creeping back up towards 200. It's been around 250 this past week. We can take that, especially with the high level of pumps that he's producing right now. Correa is back. Either he's back today or he's back yesterday. I don't actually know. But whatever guy I read online that said that the injury wasn't going to be that bad, that guy was right. So shout out to that guy. I know exactly who it is, actually, but nobody else does, so it's kind of useless shouting him out. Leadoff double, top of the ninth from Byron Buxton. By the way, Byron Buxton. Oh, Jesus Christ. Is he going to get thrown out trying to call it? Okay, never mind. Scared me. If anybody's watching this game right now, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about as they listen to it on the pod. By the way, he had the beginning of, I guess, the third game of the winning streak against the White Sox. I think it was the third game. He had a big homer to tie it up in the ninth. Then Kirilloff with the walk-off, I think, single to win it in extra innings. He's been, Buxton, I mean, has been hitting somewhat better. He's hitting the ball really well. He's still striking out just way too much. But when he hits the ball, it is hit hard usually, which is what you want. Just in general, everything's better. And it was sort of like trying to think of an analogy that isn't stupid. Like, what's the analogy about, like, the ships and, like, the tide? Like, a high tide raises all ships. It's something like that. Like, the high tide is playing the Angels and the White Sox. And so then just everybody is improved because of that. I don't think you guys needed that analogy to understand what's going on. But on the pitching side, Chris Paddock had a really good start. He sort of found some form a little bit. And then a pretty good okay one, but he's gotten a lot of run support. So he got 2 wins in the past week, so love that. Same kind of story with Pablo Lopez, 2 wins. Neither of them was actually that great of a start. It was like 4 runs in 4 innings and 3 runs in 4 innings or 4 runs in 5 innings or something like that. But and actually, the Angels' offense is, like, okay. I think each of those sort of worst starts were against the Angels, who's, like, the offense is okay. Like, Mike Trout is still there. He's leading the league in pumps, last I checked, which was a couple days ago. There are still good offense players. They are really not good on the pitching end of things, the Angels. Ryan pitched well a week ago or whatever, and pitched really well tonight. Let's go. Buxton's scoring on that. We're going ahead. We're leading the game in the ninth inning. Let's go. All right. We might get a live Twins dub on the pod, hopefully. Knock on wood. Simeon Woods Richardson. Who? Simeon Woods Richardson took a turn in the was that his debut? Let me look that up. I haven't been as locked in on the Twins. I feel like he might have pitched once before. He definitely did, right? Debut. Oh yeah, he pitched in 2022. Jesus Christ. Well, he's not an MLB regular, at least. But he pitched really well. 5 innings, 2 runs against the Angels, I believe. Good to see him get involved. Ober went 7 3 nights ago, whatever it was. Kind of rare to see it went 7, 2 runs scored. Kind of rare to see a guy go 7 in Rocco's pitching staff, but
But yeah, overall, all things are good. Obviously, we played some bad teams, so like that helps. But there's also this thing about like, I just saw it today. It's only sort of been in the news that I didn't look too much into it. It's like a Homer sausage. Homer sausage. Not Hormel sausage. Let me look this thing up. Jesus, it's just pictures of Homer Simpson. Fuck. Should have known better there. Twins. Homer sausage. What the hell is... Twins' new home run sausage is fueling their 7-game winning streak. So David Popkins brought out a... this is, by the way, we talked about the hitting coach David Popkins last week. Apparently, he's done something good now. He brought a Cloverdale Foods tangy summer sausage. Oh, I had... the real loons remember the summer sausage sandwiches for intern Allen back in the day. So, I understand the power of a good summer sausage. But the pitching coach was so bad that he had the guys... just like touch a summer sausage as if it's the Notre Dame play like a champion today sign, just touch a summer sausage before you hit, and apparently you hit a homer. Well, I guess that rocks because it's clearly working. I guess don't fire David Popkins. But yeah, Twins are back and hopefully we'll close this game out. Still don't have Duran, so I don't know who it'll be for the ninth. Maybe bring Jax out again. Maybe, well, I don't know, we'll see. Yeah, that's the Twin stuff. Let me see if I had any other notes. Okay, on to the post game. So obviously, like, I have a little bit of a job now, right? Which I think, by the way, this is maybe the real update of the post game, not what the post game is about. The real update of the post game is that my internship will turn into a full-time job when I graduate, which is great. Quitting music never went so smoothly because now I just have a job. Still need to like negotiate my salary, which like that could be a shit show, but we'll see. Any tips for negotiating a salary, I will welcome them. but now that I have a job, I'm doing a little bit of remote hours while I finish up finish up the school year, all this stuff. They should invent a desk where you like lay down, because my legs get so tired of, and my butt gets so tired of like sitting in a chair that like, I just want to go like lay down for a little bit. And it's not like every time I lay down, I'm like, oh, like this is relaxing. So I like lay on my bed, but then I like go on my phone, and then once I go on my phone and I'm laying down, then I'm like stuck. So they need to like invent a desk where you can just like lay down and just do work. And I'm not talking about like a little like thing that you put on your lap and it like you just lay in bed, but then you have like a surface to work from on your lap. Like that's not what I'm talking about. I need like a real table desk that just like has a bed under it and like maybe a backrest so you can just like lay down and do work. Like they need to invent that, because I would actually be so much more productive. Like right now I'm laying on my futon with my feet on my bed. But if there was a desk involved, like this entire podcast is I'm basically laying down every time I record this podcast. I hate sitting up. But, like, I feel like you have to, like, sit up to do work. Or, like, it's uncomfortable to, like, do stuff on your laptop while you're, like, laying down. Like, they need to invent a desk where you can lay down. And I'm not talking, like, anything to go in the bed, because I still don't want to, like, work from my bed. Because, like, that's depressing, and, like, a bed should be for sleeping. But they need to, like standing desks are a thing. What if we just, like, turned a standing desk
like we did the opposite and we did a laying down desk. Like, why is that not a thing? Let me see if it is a thing, actually. Laying down desk. Oh, it is a thing. Wait, maybe. There's a Google search entry. That's not the laying down desk at all. That's fucking stupid. That's a chair. Oh, wait. Oh, it is definitely a thing. It's $5,000? This is also not what I had in mind at all. I guess I really just want a recliner desk. That's not what I wanted. Also, why does it, like... Okay, you guys are not looking at this. Never mind. Well, apparently it's been invented, but it kind of sucks. So we need to tweak that. They need to make it, like, a luxury item that is, like, super comfortable. It looks like it's out of a hospital or, like, a dentist chair on the pictures I'm looking at. Anyway, that's the podcast. Really enlightening today. Laying down an emoji that goes with that. I don't know. Everybody pick an emoji that goes with laying down. See ya. Caleb Thielbar coming in. All right, well, you'll know what happened in this game by the time you listen to this pod. But anyway, all right, bye everyone.